Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Why do so many 21st century Muslim women cover their heads, especially when their mothers and grandmothers may not have done so when they came of age? When Leila Ahmed was growing up in Cairo in the 1940s and 50s, there was no expectation that devout Muslim women must wear hijab. It had fallen out of fashion in Egypt in the early part of the century and showed few signs of widespread return. So when she began to notice young women returning in large numbers to veiling themselves, not only in the Middle East and North Africa, but in Western countries, she wanted to understand why and found some answers she was not expecting. Leila Ahmed is Victor S. Thomas Professor of Divinity at Harvard Divinity School and author of the new book, A Quiet Revolution, The Veil's Resurgence from the Middle East to America. Leila, welcome to Think.
It's a pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
So talk a little bit more about growing up in Cairo and how your family and friends thought about hijab.
Well, it was a non-issue. There was actually no option for people of my generation growing up, as you said, in the 40s and 50s, to wear hijab. It was not something that we could have chosen to do unless we were very eccentric and very unusual. And most people I knew never occurred to them to wear hijab, of my generation then is, yeah.
And at the time, nobody thought that women not wearing the veil were any less devout as Muslims.
Absolutely not. The assumption was that they were just as devout. I mean, you know, my mother or aunt or all the relatives and their friends didn't wear hijab, and most of them considered themselves to be deeply pious Muslims. Hmm. And then, of course, so there was no connection whatever seen as between hijab and piety.
It turns out Egypt was in some ways the epicenter of the unveiling of women in the Islamic world in the early 20th century, but in fact they were heavily influenced, you discovered, by European colonial ideas.
Absolutely, that's right. Yeah, Egypt was at the epicenter. So Turkey was also extremely important, but both those two societies were grappling with ideas of whether women should or should not veil, and the intellectuals of both societies were really persuaded by what were Western arguments that veiling was a sign of Islam's inferiority and that it needed to be cast off to show that Muslim women were civilized too.
And there was this eagerness in Egypt and Turkey for people who had been born and raised there to show that they were a progressive society.
That's right, exactly. And I mean, this was partly in direct response to the Western colonial in particular. The Western assumption in general, but it was very active among the imperialist nations, that is Britain and France, which had territories in the Muslim world. They strongly made the argument that they had to be present as imperialists because the natives were inferior, not capable of making their own decisions and governing themselves. And their argument was the proof of the inferiority of the natives was they wore hijab, that women, they required women to wear hijab, and that was a sign of Islam's historic inferiority to the West. So in response, in a way, the natives began to think, well, okay, if this is a sign of inferiority, we better rethink it. And they concluded that the hijab was not necessarily part of Islam. It could be cast off. And that was a way, a kind of counter-argument to the West, saying, well, you're inferior, and until you're like us, you're not fit to govern yourselves. Hmm.
So let's talk about Evelyn Baring, known officially as Lord Cromer. He took over as British Consul General in Egypt in 1883.
Yeah. I didn't catch the beginning of your question.
I just want to talk about him because he had some very interesting ideas about women's rights in Egypt as opposed to women's rights in Great Britain, where he was from.
That's right, exactly. Interesting is one way of putting them. They were profound, directly contradictory ideas. I mean, he was in England, he was the founder of the society opposed to women's suffrage, and he spoke of women getting the vote in very derisive terms, saying these are going to be fake mannish women, and we don't want that kind of thing. It's bad for empire. We need the virility of men to rule the British Empire, and we cannot have women voting, and women are in their proper place in British society. They are the guardians of morality, and they have all the rights they need. And this is an era when women in England had very few rights. Actually, they were struggling then to get not only the vote but also property rights. So, but he thought everything was the way it should be in England, and he opposed voting. But as a British representative in Egypt, and in fact, ruler of Egypt. He claimed that the only way women were going to be progress in Egypt was if they cast off the veil. At the same time, he closed down schools for women, so he was a very contradictory, but it was really a very imperialist way of defining what women's rights. It was one thing for Western women, another for Native women.
Yeah, when you say closed down schools, this was for boys and girls. The British government was not going to provide free public education in Egypt.
That's right, that's right. There had been public education that had been gradually increasing in Egypt when the British came in, and he phased out free public education for both men and women, girls and boys.
So, Leila, to the extent that Egyptians sort of came under the influence of Lord Cromer and other people he was aligned with and said, okay, the veil needs to be set aside to show that we are a modern society and we are progressing, were the responses of men any different from the responses of women to this idea?
Men were actually the most vocal on the issue of women's unveiling. They took the position that women had to unveil. But if you look closely at their arguments really were that the West had a better style of patriarchy. That's not how they put it. They argued that, you know, the West was clearly very civilized. They had all these wonderful inventions of railway lines. And the late 19th century was the era of Western really tremendous strides technologically. Mm-hmm. And this was very impressive to most societies. So they put that as a model, and they said, well, this society is progressing in the way that we want to progress too. And they also argued, and they, as far as I can see, they genuinely believe that the veil was not necessarily part of Islam, that it had been a cultural accretion. It's something that Islam had adopted over the centuries. So they argued for setting aside the veil in the interest of becoming like the West, and modern and technologically advanced and so on, and democratic and self-governing. The women, I think, also were part of this general argument, but there was also the additional edge for them that actually did. You know, I have to change course as I'm speaking, because I just realized, in fact, there were men and women for whom unveiling was the symbol of advancement, mm-hmm. for both men and women. And if we think of those societies in the early 20th century, there were societies in which class was much more important than merit, than work. Gender divisions were very strong. Ethnic divisions were, the likelihood of people getting jobs was often tied to who they knew. So the West at that point represented not the ideal, not only technologically, but in terms of the ideas of a democratic meritocracy. And that was something people desired very much. So both men and women used the symbol of the veil as for them, it came to be imbued with the meaning of a society of equality for all. Hmm. So both men and women wanted to unveil, argued for unveiling.
What does the Quran say about Muslim women covering their heads and their bodies in public?
Well, you know, you find a lot of arguments on both sides by people who are specialists interpreting the verse of the Quran. And I think the line that I must take is I'm not a specialist in early Quranic Arabic. I will simply point out to the people who are expert linguists. And, of course, we must bear in mind that the Quran is a 7th century text. So it's an ancient form of Arabic, mm-hmm. and you need to be very specialized to interpret it. But all I will point to is that there are people on both sides who argue, some who argue that it's absolutely required, others who argue that it's not required. And that itself points to the complexity of interpreting the Quran and the the role that interpretation plays in all religious texts. So I will not. I will simply point to the fact that there are different interpretations.
That was very gracefully handled, by the way. Thank you. So we know that people have been arguing about interpretations for a very long time. One thing that's really interesting is the fluidity with which what the veil represents seems to change, even among the current generation of women wearing it. People wear it for different reasons. Can you talk a little bit about what different women told you the veil represented for them?
Yes. Well, we're talking now about people in America, primarily in America, but in the West generally. Mm-hmm. And I think the key thing one has to bear in mind is what the veil means in the West is very different from what it means in in the home countries. And it makes a huge difference whether it's a country which requires veiling, say Saudi Arabia or Iran, and then a country which does not require it, and then the Western countries where often it is even not, it is frowned upon, as in France or Germany or elsewhere. So one has to think of that. So I have had people tell me that they wear it out of sense of pride in their heritage, and particularly this is after 9/11, mm-hmm. That it means to them the affirmation of the sense of that they are Muslim, that they're proud of this heritage, in the context of people who of a society which denigrates Islam and paints it in negative terms. I've had people, young women, tell me that they wear it as a way of challenging gender stereotypes. You know, it's a way of saying to other people in society, well, think about how you dress and the sexism of Western women's dress. So all of these are part of the possible meanings. Of course, we should remember that there's also what people don't really often talk about, but is there present, that for some people it is, it has above all, religiously prescribed dress. And some of them, in fact, one person explained to me that she wore it for the same reason that her Jewish friends wore yarmulkes, as a way of making people aware in the society in which she lived in America that they were Muslims here, they were people who were adhering to their religious faith, and they deserved to be respected as a minority. So all of these possibilities and meanings were there.
Leila Ahmed is my guest. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's go on the phones now to Southlake and speak with Amar. Hi, Amar.
Hi. I just had a question about veiling. You talked about in the 40s and the 50s, a lot of, I guess, your relatives and friends chose to not wear the veil. I was just wondering how much of it had to do with socioeconomic background as opposed to their religious views. Ones that were more, I guess the upper class, was it more the upper class that chose not to wear the veil, or were there always also people from the lower classes, the ones that were not as maybe educated as yourself, that also chose to do the same?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. I think it certainly began in the early 20th century as a very much a class issue. It was the elite, it was the upper middle classes and the upper classes who in particular espoused the ideas of unveiling, but it very quickly became widespread. I mean, when I grew up, it was the vast majority of the cities of that I saw as a youngster, of Cairo, Alexandria, vast majority of people did not wear it. So progressively it spread across society, began, as you rightly suggested by your question, in among the elite classes, but it did spread. By the age of Nasser, which was when there were socialist ideas in Egypt and elsewhere, actually, in the Middle East, it became commonplace. The veil became commonplace across society, even reaching into the small towns as well as the major urban centers. And the urban centers across the Muslim world by the 1940s and 50s, women were, the majority were not wearing hijab. So through the 50s and 60s, it spread really across classes. I wouldn't claim that it was invariable or class. Everybody didn't wear it. And as you rightly pointed out, it was either the agricultural or the working classes who might not have unveiled quite as readily. But it was still a majority. The vast majority of women did not wear hijab. In fact, we have a report of Abdel Nasser, President of Egypt, being asked in 1961.
Leila, let me jump in here. We have to take a quick break and we'll finish this thought in a moment. My guest is Leila Ahmed. Her new book is called A Quiet Revolution, The Veil's Resurgence from the Middle East to America.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a self-designed graduate program that allows you the chance to meet the challenges of society. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Victor S. Thomas Professor of Divinity at Harvard Divinity School, Leila Ahmed. Her new book is called A Quiet Revolution, The Veil's Resurgence from the Middle East to America. You can be part of our conversation by calling in to 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. And Leila, before the break, you were responding to Amar's question and talking about the fact that elite classes were indeed the first to unveil, but were followed by others.
Yes, and you know, all that was actually too generalized, because there are plenty of examples in the early 20th century of women who were working class, who for whom unveiling meant all kinds of aspirations. There was, I use the example of a woman called Musa, who cast it off as a way of asserting her right to equality in all ways. She was a professional woman of working class origins, of poor origins, and so it was even then something that many people desired, not only the elite, but it was overall an ideology, an ethos pursued by the elite. But by the mid-century, this was no longer the case, and we do have an example, as I was saying, of somebody calling in a speech that Nasser was making, somebody calling out to him in 1961, saying you should require women to wear hijab, and he said, I'm not going to take on half the population of this country. So that means that he thought half the population of Egypt at that point, that is the women, were against veiling.
So let's talk about the resurgence of veiling. One very influential figure in this was quite influential in the formation of the Muslim Brotherhood. Can you tell us about Zainab al-Ghazali?
Yes, she was an extraordinary woman, really, and I'm sure there's going to be many studies of her, ongoing studies of her. She was she began her life as a... She joined the feminist movement, founded by some of the elite women that I talked about earlier, of the early 20th century, a woman called Hoda Sharawi, who founded an Egyptian feminist union in the 1920s. Zainab al-Ghazali joined her movement, joined her organization in the 1930s, and within a few months left it to found her own Islamic women's organization, because she thought the feminist union was much too westernized, and she wanted to anchor her call for women's rights in Islam and not in Western ideals, because she believed that Islam gave women all the rights that they could possibly want. So that was in 1936. At the age of 18, she founded that organization, and she developed a relation with some of the major leaders of the Muslim world, among them the founder of the Muslim Brotherhood, Hassan al-Banna. And when he was assassinated in late 1940s and came under, and the Muslim Brotherhood were persecuted by the Nasser regime through the 50s, Zainab al-Ghazali began to take on a leading role in helping and sustaining that organization. And she was a leading voice. She was argued both for feminism and for Islam, but feminism in a very particular, what she thought to be an Islamic way.
And she was quite committed to the ideals of very modest traditional dress for Muslim women.
Absolutely. There she did not veer from that. She certainly dressed completely in Islamic dress. She also believed, as we know from an interview she had with a woman from the Christian Science Monitor who reported this in the 1980s, believed that this was required of Christianity too, that women should cover just as the Muslim women should cover. And in fact, if you think about the way, I mean, after all, it's not so long ago that women stopped wearing veils in church in the Western world, in Christian world. I think it goes back to the 60s and 70s. Many women I know, Catholic women, have told me that they wouldn't have dreamt of going to church without a hat or a covering of their head. So this was common to many religions, and Zainab al-Ghazali took that position that this is what women, faithful religious women, should be, how they should be dressing. And in fact, of course, we should point out that for some Jewish women, covering head is still required.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We'll speak with Ryan in Dallas. Hi, Ryan.
Hey, how are you? I actually grew up in the Middle East in Saudi Arabia and have a lot of friends from all over the world, and have actually very close Muslim two sisters of mine, and one has chosen to wear the hijab, and the other one remains and chooses not to. So this is very interesting to me. But I was in Cairo in December, And my guide, I asked her how you could tell the difference between the Muslim women and the Christian women, because even the Christian women in a more traditional area of town where we were all wearing head coverings, too. And I was wondering if you knew anything about this. They seemed to be older women, but it just pretty much all looked the same. And she said, and she was Muslim herself and said she couldn't tell the difference if she was walking down the street.
That she could not tell the difference, you're saying?
Right, between a Christian woman or a Muslim in
Cairo.
That's
right. Well, thank you very much for raising that question. That's really an important issue, because before the unveiling began, which is in response to the imperialism, which began in the early 20th century, actually, women in Jewish, Christian, and Muslim women, all who lived in Middle Eastern societies, all wore some kind of head covering. And we know that from reports of the exchanges that we read in magazines in the early 20th century, the Jewish and Christian women, just as well as Muslim women, debated whether they should or should not unveil and whether it was proper or not. So it was at that point, it was just the norm of women's dress in Middle Eastern societies, in Muslim-dominated societies. We know that Christian and Jewish women unveil about the same rate as Muslim women in the early 20th century, sometimes a little bit ahead, but often not. So this was simply the norm of dress, and it was only after imperialism that it came to be identified as specifically Muslim and only Muslim dress, and really in response to the Western notion that it was a sign of Islamic inferiority. So it was only of that point, after that point, that it began to take on the identity of being only a symbol of Islam. But as the example you give, for some women this is completely invalid, and Christian women also continue to wear it today.
So how did the Arab-Israeli wars affect the wearing of the veil in the Middle East?
I can't say that they affected it directly, although today, among the reasons, today in America, among the reasons women give post 9/11 for wearing the veil is that some of them wear it as a way of indicating their support for this Palestinian cause, as well as more generally as a way of protesting the stereotyping, the negative stereotyping of Muslims. As some of them also wear it as a protest against the war in Iraq in particular. But I can't say that the Israeli conflict directly, at least in earlier period, affected it, except that the Muslim Brotherhood, who were very important to the revival, the return of the veil in the 1970s, were very critical took a very strong stance in support of Palestinians and therefore were critical of Israeli actions in relation to Palestinians. So to that extent, it was part of it. But I'm not sure that one can link it directly to that.
And contrary to how many Western observers might see this, as the veil took on a renewed significance as a sign of Muslim piety, donning it actually gave many women an opportunity to do things that women would not have done in the past, but still sort of show the world that they were devout Muslims, according to the fact that they were wearing the veil.
That's right. I think one of the things that's happened as a result of the 1970s rebirth of veiling is that it's actually lost its old patriarchal meanings. It hasn't lost them completely. I mean, for some people, it still has patriarchal meanings, but for others, it does not. And this happened in the beginning of the 1970s as women themselves began to define the meaning of wearing hijab, and it allowed them to be. I mean, we really need to make the distinction. Actually, when you say that it gave them freedoms that they hadn't had, that is in Muslim-majority societies. In America, they have these freedoms of being able to go into the workplace and so on. But in Muslim-majority societies, where there were taboos about mixing, easy mixing or in genders, wearing hijab enabled women to go out into space and to take on positions, for instance, working in an office with men, that it would have been much more difficult for them to take on as people who are wearing Western style dress.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Plano and speak with Shahab. Hi, Shahab.
Hey, Chris, how you doing?
Great, thanks.
Just had a quick question about whaling here in America. We here in the U.S. have shown so much tolerance, religious tolerance, yet we have not seen or have not been reciprocated by the Muslim woman moving around in the society, and yet there is still a lot of difference in their thinking, and I don't see a lot of support for American cause or U.S. policies, even living in U.S. society with there is religious tolerance and they're accepted in the society and they're respected in the society. Yet those very same women don't show a lot of support or patriotism. Why?
Well, I'm not sure that I know what you mean. Why, where the evidence, what your evidence is that they don't support patriotism? The kind of the women that I've spoke to are profoundly American in their commitment. So I don't quite know why you think that. I mean, standing by what you believe your religion demands of you is a profoundly American value, you know. So you don't expect people of other religions to abandon their religious beliefs in order to show their, their patriotism, and I don't think Muslims do either. They are Americans. They feel deeply American, but they also want to cherish what is their own particular heritage. And in fact, one could argue that they really are upholding the American values of equality and freedom for all by insisting that America stands by its commitment to equality for minorities.
Let's talk about the choice issue. At least we'll talk about it in the United States first. Women in this country, you find, not only are making the choice themselves to wear the veil or not, but sometimes they make it in opposition of what their families might want for them.
That's quite true. There are plenty of examples of families who are just appalled when their daughters start wearing hijab because they did not wear it, and they think it's going to be hamper their daughter's progress in the society or their professional progress if they wear hijab. So there are plenty of examples of this kind of reaction from parents. Although one also hears, the charge that parents are imposing it on their children. So perhaps there's a grain of truth on both sides. But of course, as children grow up, even if it's imposed by parents, they are able to choose it mostly in this society. But I do think what you point to is an important element of all this, which is there is a generational, it's an issue of generational challenge too, in which young people who take on wearing hijab are actually saying to their parents, well, this is what I think Islam is, and maybe your Islam was not as good as it should have been, and I'm going to stand by this, and it's also, it's a way of asserting independence.
On the other hand, for you, does the veil have a different symbolism in countries like, as you mentioned, Iran and Saudi Arabia and certainly parts of Afghanistan today that are still controlled by the Taliban?
Yeah.
Is it less a symbol of women's liberation than a symbol of women's oppression in those places where women are required to wear it to step out of the house?
Yeah, well, I wouldn't call it women's oppression. I mean, I think it cannot be a symbol of feminism in Saudi Arabia or anywhere where it's required by women. So that meaning is not an option in countries, or even in Egypt, where there's a lot of social pressure, even if it's not required by law.
Yeah.
So it's not to me. I don't see it as a possible as feminism as part of its possible meanings. But I don't think see it. On the other hand, as a symbol of oppression, because I've heard many Saudi women say that actually that's how they're comfortable. This is the dress that they're comfortable wearing. So I don't. I think it's our perception that it is oppression. It's not necessarily any more oppressive. And, it's worth remembering that at the time that the West defined the veil as oppressive, they were wearing, their model of what a woman's dress should be was late 19th century British dress, which included corsets for women, which broke their ribs, and all kinds of uncomfortable, completely unfeminist ways of dress.
Yeah, they were not letting it all hang out in the late 19th century.
It's all about perception. I don't automatically. I mean, I've learned. I mean, I actually have to admit that I began, when I first set out to write this book, by assuming that there was inescapably some meaning of women's oppression in the veil. I no longer think that, because I think it's a matter of perception, and that what society you're in, what moment in history you're in, shapes what you assume is oppression. And I don't think there's something intrinsically more oppressive about hijab now. I no longer think that.
We have an email here from Carrie who writes, "Our brains are wired to recognize faces, and the emotions that show on our face can elicit empathy and compassion. When we take away a woman's face, we're putting people into a state of blindness, which can lead to a lack of empathy that's harmful for our humanity. As progressives, we should be standing up for the rights of women, not for the right for them to be oppressed." We should make it clear that we're talking here about hijab and not niqab, which is what covers the entire face. But,
yes.
But do you want to respond to that statement?
Yeah, I think the distinction we need to make is, you're quite right, we're talking not about a facial covering, but about a head covering of some sort. But the other issue is, you know, by definition, if you think of helmets, for instance, for knights, by definition, the people who see but are not seen are usually the powerful.
Hmm.
Kings and queens used to be hidden. In fact, that's certainly the term in the Muslim history anyway, that the caliph of the country, the ruler, was veiled. And so it is a power to see and not be seen. And one of the, when people speculate as to why the veil came to be seen as in such a negative light by Westerners, not by other people, but by Westerners, was that when Western men first visited Muslim countries, they had no visual access to women. They could not see them. And that frustrated them, whereas, you know, in the West, they're used to expecting to be able to inspect a woman's body and to see how sexy she is or to see her. And that was denied them, and that perhaps angered them.
Leila Ahmed is my guest. She's Victor S. Thomas Professor of Divinity at Harvard Divinity School and author of the new book, A Quiet Revolution, The Veil's Resurgence from the Middle East to America. Join in the conversation by calling now. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a self-designed graduate program that allows you the chance to meet the challenges of society. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Leila Ahmed. She is Victor S. Thomas Professor of Divinity at Harvard Divinity School and author of the new book, A Quiet Revolution, The Veil's Resurgence from the Middle East to America. Join in the conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Let's go next on the phones to Tim in Southlake. Hello, Tim.
Hi. I just recently moved back from Malaysia after a couple years, and went to Indonesia a fair bit too, which is the world's largest Muslim country in population. And I noticed in Malaysia very high wearing of the hijab, versus Indonesia, you'd hardly know you were in a Muslim country except for the call to prayer. So I think the society, the social things you were talking about, each country seems to appear, at least there, seems to have a sense of its own societal reasons for wearing it or not wearing it.
What do you think about that, Leila?
Yeah, I think you're quite right. I think there are a number of forces at work. I mean, there is the local, what is happening locally and how they see it, but also we are today in a global world, so there are forces and influences working across the world, either changing or influencing each other. So both things are active today, and I think you're right. In some places, they stick by their local traditions, and in other places there are global influences that are coming in and changing what's happening.
Do you think the perception of the non-Muslim community in the United States is changing toward women who choose to wear the veil in this country?
Yes, on the whole, I do think so. I actually think it's somewhat a generational matter, because I find that young people seem to be completely accepting, because the other one element to bear in mind is that we have the young people who are coming of age who are Muslim today are the children either of people who immigrated in the 1960s, or they're the children of African-American, often converts to Islam, and the conversion rate also began to increase in, among African-Americans and other groups beginning of the 1960s. So we have now a generation of young people, both of immigrant and African-American descent, who grew up wearing hijab and now in their 20s and 30s, and people of their who are their cohorts who are non-Muslim have grown up with the hijab as a norm for among some of their friends and colleagues.
Mm-hmm.
So for them, the veil is a non-issue almost. For the older generation, it's anyone over 30 or 35, it's a much tougher struggle to accept it. But the younger people, I find, are quite comfortable with it.
Let's go back to the phones. This time we'll speak with Ramez in Arlington. Hi, Ramez.
Yes. I just want to make a point. The argument that Jewish and Christian people used to wear veils, or that English women used to wear in the 19th century, is not an argument that this is a proper thing to do. Because all reactionary people look to the past and say, that's how we used to do it, so that's how we should do it now. So my main issue is that if somebody doesn't want to wear it, why should we put social pressure on them to wear it? And I'll just hang up and take your comment.
Okay, well, thank you for your question. I'm not at all arguing that we should make anybody wearing it. My argument is not supporting that. I'm just analyzing what is it, what people wish to do, and we should respect whatever it is, however they wish to dress, within limits of what society considers acceptable, obviously, because all dress has to in some way conform to what society considers to be acceptable. But certainly I'm not arguing for imposing the veil on anybody.
May I ask you this? You were candid about the fact that you were raised in a devout Muslim home and that wearing the veil was not expected for anyone within your family on a regular basis. In going through and doing this research and changing somewhat your perception of what the veil means today to women who choose to wear it, did you at all reconsider your decision not to wear the veil?
No, I didn't. And that's such a complicated subject that I don't quite know how to address it. It would take a few hours to explain. But I think one of the conclusions that I could not fail to but become aware of is where we are, where we grew up, those perceptions that are automatic to us are learned perceptions.
Mm-hmm.
There's no universal meaning to them, and we have to understand that. And I think wherever we're from, that and whatever moment in history we're from, and that makes a difference too. I think I'm just learning. I just came to understand the sheer plasticity of human perception.
Well, I think that's a great point as well, because it may be that, you know, we have these perceptions that we're sort of born with, and we feel like they're our own opinions, and they come strictly from within us, but of course there are cultural overlays to all of this. It sort of requires all of us to just examine why we think the way we do.
Absolutely. You've got it in a nutshell. That's the essence of where I stand now, I think.
Let's go back to the phones at 1-800-933-5372. We have Anna on the line in Dallas. Hi, Anna.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I returned from Istanbul last month, and I saw a number of billboards of women using veils and announcing very fashionable brands of either clothes or sunglasses. And I asked my friend that if it was a fashionable issue, and she definitely said that wearing a veil had become a trendy issue. And I wanted to ask your guest if, to what extent or to what percentage, this is an issue that women are choosing to veil themselves out of fashion.
And another wonderful question. I think you're absolutely right. They are. Dress is fashion. One of the elements of it is that. And if We know that some people who wear hijab, those who are very wealthy, get them designed by Christian Dior or any of the French great French houses, fashion houses. So it is all fashion is also part of it. One tends to leave it out of the picture, but it's absolutely essential. It's dress is dress, and it is about fashion by definition, among other things. So different people will emphasize different aspects of what the veil means to them, but for many, it may be simply the norms of dress in their particular community, and they want to be as fashionable as possible.
It is a remarkable statement about the times we live in. As I was reading through the book, I would go online and look things up here and now and again. And Nike, the sportswear company, is now designing appropriate attire for Muslim girls and young women to participate in sports.
Well, yeah, that's wonderful, actually. That's actually it's a wonderful point. You're quite right. It is about both fashion and commerce, you know, and business. And that's quite clearly part of what's happening. There's a huge industry now to produce suitable attire for Muslim women.
So what sort of symbol has the veil become in places like, as you mentioned earlier, France and Germany, where lawmakers have, to varying degrees of success, tried to restrict Muslim women's right to dress however they see fit, if that includes the veil or the niqab?
Yeah, I think one of the interests, I mean, obviously America makes no such restrictions, and I think our history of being aware of the issue of minority and minority rights and religious rights has given America an edge in thinking about the whole issue of veiling, which the European world is still struggling with. So I do think it's much more a scary symbol, it seems to be, for Europeans. And, you know, when I was following the arguments that were recently over the niqab, which is the face covering, which is a very rare, actually, form of dress in France, where it was recently banned, you know, as I recall, leading people in government, including, I believe, Sarkozy, were arguing that it's the reason they were restricting it was because it was patriarchal oppression, represented male oppression. They weren't making the argument that it's an issue of security, but that it was an issue of oppression. And I really found that kind of ludicrous because, you know, there are people who would argue that wearing bikinis is also a sexist issue. So I don't think that's a valid argument at all.
Well, it is an interesting argument also, given that, you know, if you have the male head of a country declaring that he's going to fix patriarchal oppression by not allowing women to wear a particular garment.
That's right. You hit the nail on the head, yes.
How do you see responses evolving among people who are in that sort of middle generation? You mentioned that younger people are completely, or for the most part, completely comfortable with this in this country. What about people who are in their 30s and 40s and 50s? Do you imagine that their views will change as this starts to be something they see more commonly among coworkers and neighbors and that sort of thing?
My guess is yes, that it will change, yes.
Mm-hmm. What do things look like on the Harvard campus these days?
Hijab is fairly common in Cambridge as a whole. I don't quite, yeah, I think it's certainly, I mean, there's been a noticeable increase across the country between the 90s and today in hijab, and it's partly because these generations who were the children of Muslims who whose numbers began to increase in the 1960s, are now coming of age and entering universities and entering the professions and so on. So it is becoming much more common, and I think by the virtue of that, at least in America, people are becoming more accepting of it. And actually, I've just been in England, and I found that, on the whole, people are quite accepting of it over there, too.
We can't have this conversation without also addressing the conversations that this that the decision to wear the veil or not inspires among women in the Muslim community. Can you talk about some of the discussions and debates and compromises that people make?
Well, I think there's a whole lot of debates going on among young women. Some of them there's to some extent a trend among women who grew up assuming that it was a normal part of dress, who are now questioning whether it is. There's a strong sense that among women who either wear it or once wore it, that they've had enough of this subject. We don't endlessly discuss why people are wearing jeans. Why should we discuss why people wear cover their heads, mm-hmm. you know? So many of them are tired of the entire subject and want it to be a matter of something that you don't comment on or just don't notice any more than you notice any other kind of dress, whether women are or are not wearing hijab. There is also a historical divide between women who are growing up wearing it and those who for whom it was like people of my own generation and some other younger people, Americans, who also come from traditions in which wearing hijab is not relevant. So there are all kinds of conversations going on among Muslim women. And whether it means the fact that you don't wear it, does it mean that you're necessarily secular? That's a whole further dimension of the debate.
Mm-hmm. Do you think those debates are healthy for Muslim identity?
Absolutely, yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, I think debate about anything, open discussion about anything is always healthy.
In Egypt itself, has the wearing of hijab or not played any role in the interaction of people who have been demonstrating for democracy?
No, that's a very interesting point. As far as I can make out, we saw people in hijab and people in no hijab, without hijab, being very active in calling for democracy and calling for equal rights. And so I think we seem to be moving beyond the point when it matters whether when women wear hijab or not, and that it's clear that women in hijab are just as committed to equal rights as are women who don't wear hijab.
You have said that you went into this project expecting to come to different conclusions that you did. Is that something that as an academic sort of delights you when something like that happens?
It does delight me, but I have to tell you, it was tough. I mean, I had to keep rethinking what I was doing. It's like cutting away the ground from under one's feet, but that's what was happening. And it's exciting. It makes it exciting.
Leila Ahmed is Victor S. Thomas Professor of Divinity at Harvard Divinity School, and she's the author of the new book, A Quiet Revolution, The Veil's Resurgence from the Middle East to America. Leila, it's been a really interesting discussion. Thank you so much for giving us this hour.
It's been a pleasure to be with you. Thank you so much.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
Think production team includes engineer Nilufer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.